And we got there, Wendy, myself, Esperanza Reyes, and Barbara Briggs from my office, and we were real nervous because we had heard that the Republicans were going to try to get us. These were official hearings held by the Republicans. And a woman named Desqua Debbie was in charge of pulling together the hearings. She used to work for Helms, and she got the nickname Desqua Debbie because she was a major player with the Contras, raising money for the Contras. She left the United States, and she married a right-wing general in Honduras. But this case was so big, they brought Desqua Debbie back from Honduras so she could work all her congressional contacts in the Congress. So we knew we were walking into a fierce fight, and we were afraid to go in. So we stayed outside and tried to just talk to each other. And we're standing. It's a very gloomy day. And we're standing there, and all of a sudden, the sky opens up a little bit, and a ray of light comes right through and hits Wendy. And we're all standing there like that. And our eyes, we are like shocked. Well, we go into the place, and she just wiped them out, completely demolished. All of the pinstripe suits were there from Honduras. They had business people, members of the government. She cleaned the ground with them to the point where Republicans were saying back to these business people from Honduras that little Wendy is doing more to protect jobs and dignity in Honduras than all you people put together. Come back and see us when you're serious. And these people were like really nervous after those hearings. But that's the impact this kid had. It was extraordinary. Well, I'm in a cab in New York City, coming back from a meeting, and I hear beep, 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 beep. Kathy Lee Gifford's going to meet with Wendy Diaz in the National Labor Committee. So I knew we were meeting. I heard about it on the radio. So I go back to my office, and sure enough, I get a call. Now, at this particular moment, they had taken duct tape and put it around Kathy Lee's mouth because she wasn't doing so good, and they hired Howard Rubenstein, the biggest PR firm in New York. They run entire governments. So I get a call from the PR firm, and they say, will you meet? And I say, of course we'll meet. Very anxious to meet. And the guy says, well, where do you want to meet? And I said, a church. And he screams over the thing, what the hell do you want to meet in a church for? And I wasn't going to explain this to him, but we have a big name, the National Labor Committee, but we have a staff of four people. So we never let anybody into our office because it's all smoke and mirrors. And so what we do is we meet in churches and find out the companies feel very nervous in church. And I met with Walmart in a progressive church in Greenwich Village, and I noticed they're always looking over their shoulders, and they get very nervous, and it makes them think that we have some very powerful friends on our side, and they don't like it. So we continue to do this. But this was my mistake, because I found out that Kathy Lee was good friends with Cardinal O'Connor. So we met in a church, but it was St. Patrick's Cathedral, and it wasn't the small activist churches I was thinking of. So the day of the meeting comes around, and we were meeting like on a Wednesday morning, and sure enough, we get to the meeting. And sure enough, we're terrified again. We'd never met Kathy Lee Gifford. We didn't know what she looked like in real life. And we didn't know what to expect. So we hit across the street, like we always do. So we're on 51st Street, and we're looking at the Cardinal's residency, and Wendy's much smaller than I am. We're looking around the corner of the building. She's looking around, I'm looking around. Sure enough, Kathy Lee comes, and they don't go anywhere alone, these rich people. A whole entourage comes. Public relations people, lawyers, company people. And since she cries a lot, someone carries Kleenexes. Well, they go into the meeting, and we build up our courage, and we go in. And my first remark was, my first feelings was, you know, how nice the Cardinal lived. It was a tremendous apartment. And the furniture was big, and they put me right next to Kathy Lee Gifford, who was on a couch, and I'm on a rocking chair. And I was nervous to begin with, but once I got in the rocking chair, I couldn't stop it from rocking. My feet were barely touching the ground. I'm rocking back and forth. And I'm staring at Kathy Lee Gifford. I can't take my eyes off her. I'm rocking back and forth looking at her. And I look around the room, and other people are staring at her, and Wendy is staring at her. Wendy was like, her eyes are bulging, and she's staring at Kathy Lee. And I asked her afterwards, what were you looking at? And what it turned out is Kathy Lee had come right from her set, her TV program. And if you're not used to seeing these people, they wear so much makeup that it's startling. I mean, it's about like a half an inch thick. You can't see a line or an expression. And she looked like she was embalmed. And it was scary to me. Wendy had never seen anything like it in her life, and she was going to get up and bolt and run out of there. I mean, it was like pretty frightening stuff. But eventually, we got control of the rocking chair, and the meeting starts. And Kathy Lee says to Wendy, Wendy, tell me about your life. You know, she's really interested in. We had heard one of the things that they were thinking of doing, Kathy Lee and Frank, was to buy Wendy and adopt her. Because if you buy her, you can shut her up. So we crushed that in 2 seconds. But so the meeting starts, and they say, oh, Wendy, tell me about your life. And I'm sitting there praying to myself, Wendy, don't fall for it. don't start talking, oh, Kathy Lee, you're so beautiful, and New York is so spectacular, and Honduras is so poor, and we've got dirt roads. Wendy didn't fall for it. She looked right back at Kathy Lee Gifford, and without bat an eyelash, in rapid succession, she told Kathy Lee what it was like to live in one room with 11 people. She told Kathy Lee what it was like to earn 31 cents an hour and frequently go to bed hungry because you don't have the money to buy enough food with. She told Kathy Lee Gifford what you felt like when they pick up the garments and throw them in your face in the factory because they say you made a mistake or you're not going fast enough, and they curse at you and call you a chicken head. She told Kathy Lee Gifford what you felt like when you couldn't go to the bathroom and your body hurt because they limited it to once in the morning, once in the afternoon, and how humiliated you felt, and how pain, and what kind of pain it actually was. And she told Kathy Lee Gifford what it was like to come out of work at 9 o'clock at night in a pitch darkness in a poor area with no public transportation, when you gather together with the other little kids and you run home together, whistling and singing because you're afraid you're going to be raped or assaulted, and you hang out together and run home for protection. When she finished, Kathy Lee Gifford became a human being for 15 seconds and apologized to Wendy. It was a remarkable scene. She leaned over this Hollywood personality and she said, "Please believe me, I didn't know. I had no idea. And now that I know, I'm going to work with you, I'm going to work with these other people, I will never allow it to happen again." That night we signed an agreement with Kathy Lee Gifford that she would never again tolerate sweatshops, that her factories around the world would be open to independent inspection by religious, labor rights, and human rights leaders to guarantee compliance with human rights and labor rights, and that workers around the world should be paid a living wage so they and their families could live in dignity. She signed that last part because I don't think she knew what it was, living wage. But, you know, I doubt many people here read The Enquirer. I did an interview with them. At first I thought I was being interviewed by the Philadelphia Inquirer. Then the questions became weirder and weirder, and I realized this is a different newspaper. But anyway, they just put out like a two-page story on Kathy Lee Gifford, which was really quite interesting. They compared the mansions that the Giffords have, a $5 million mansion in Greenwich, Connecticut, $1 million apartment in New York, $1 million Palm Beach thing in Florida, and Aspen, Colorado, with the homes of the workers in El Salvador that make the Kathy Lee pants. And they compared the lives of the children in Salvador, of the mothers making the clothing, with Cody and Cassidy, those two things that she's always talking about on television. Anyway, very interesting. They spend $36 a week on dog food, and the family in El Salvador is trying to live on these starvation wages. Well, at any rate, the meeting was ending, and Kathy Lee tried to make one last attempt to get us all to cry, and I knew it was coming because they're passing the Kleenexes out. And I got a few of them. And Kathy Lee says to little Wendy, she says, Wendy, do you know how sad it was for me when my two little kids come to me and say to me, "Mommy, Mommy, why is everybody saying such bad things about you on television?" And she expected us all to burst into tears. Nobody cried, the Kleenexes were collected, and the meeting was over. But nothing really changed. Not long after that, we found these Kathy Lee pocketbooks made in China. The same hand tag, you buy this pocketbook, you can help the little kiddies. Well, they again leave out the fact that young women in China make the pocketbooks, forced to work 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, they pay them 12 and a half cents an hour. So obviously that's $1.25 a day, $8.75 for the week. But they house in dormitories and they take out $5.41. That leaves them with $3.44 after a 70-hour work week making pocketbooks for Kathy Lee Gifford. And we're to believe that exploitation in China is going to help little kiddies in the United States. It's incredible lies on the part of Walmart and Kathy Lee. These are the dormitories. 16 people will be stuffed into a room. Army bunk beds will be pushed up against each other. And in these thin bunk beds, there'll be two women on each level of the bunk bed. And they hang up cardboard and cloth for privacy. In the mornings, they're fed a thin rice gruel, and for lunch and supper, stir-fried vegetables. But don't think that Walmart and the other U.S. companies aren't human, because they are. When the workers work past midnight, the next day they get a special treat. They get the rice gruel and bread. So you got to hand it to them. It's not, there's parts of them that are human. It's not just Walmart either. It's more. This Teletubby I carry around. It's a Teletubby, of course. Jerry Falwell attacked viciously because said it was gay. Now, he's certainly off the wall, this guy. But there is a story behind the Teletubby. And that story is, of course, it, like all toys, was made in China. And the Teletubby is the largest selling toy in the United States. $1 billion the American people spent on the Teletubbies. $1 billion. It's made in China by young women 17 to 25 years of age. They work, it's a factory called Door Lock. They work 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. They work from 7 o'clock in the morning until 1 o'clock at night. They're allowed 4 hours of sleep. They get a half a day off a month, which is payday. That's their break. They're paid 13 cents an hour. So for the 112-hour week, they get paid $14.42. But they take out $2.40 for dorm expenses, so it ends up leaving them with $12.02 for 112 hours of work. This Ellen Tracy garment, it's $155, made in China. The workers who made it got paid 23 cents an hour. You talk about the markup. 23 cents an hour, and they work from 7:30 in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. This lapel pin I carried around, can't get anybody interested in it. The media doesn't think it's a story. This lapel pin was made for the Republican National Committee. And they interviewed the owner of the company. He was like entrepreneur, small business entrepreneur of the year. And they asked him, how do you do it? You know, this stuff's very competitive. You got to paint and you're hand polishing. Anyway, this guy made a mistake. He told the truth to a small business magazine, which someone then sent me. He said, I'll tell you how I do it. They sold 250,000 of these to the Republicans. He said, I'll tell you how I do it to the Republican Party. I have a factory in China. I have 250 workers. I own them. That's a direct quote. They work from 7 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. They live 16 to a room. I pay them 9 cents an hour, and they're mostly little girls from the countryside. So little girls from the countryside work until 11 o'clock at night and paid 9 cents an hour are making these lapel pins, but that's not a story. No one's interested in it.
If I could just tell one last story about Walmart, and then I'm going to finish. Walmart is a very patriotic company. Again, very interesting. If you go into the Walmarts, the flags and the banners and bring it home to the USA, made right here, proud of our neighbors who made these products, support American manufacturers that support American jobs. This intrigued me a lot because Walmart was actually saying, if that was true, that they wouldn't enter the race to the bottom, that they wouldn't chase 9-cent wages around the world, that there were standards below which they wouldn't go. Human rights standards, women rights standards, labor rights standards, wage standards below which they wouldn't go. So I called Walmart and I said, well, I'm interested in your Buy America policy. How many of your goods are actually made in the United States? And there was this stupid silence on the other side of the phone, and they said, we can't tell you. We don't know, they said, which, of course, is stupid. They have the largest private data bank in the world. They monitor every single product in the Walmarts. So I figured, once again, something's going on here. So we decided to go into Walmart and start counting clothing. And I wouldn't advise this to anybody. I spent an entire summer doing it. You'll lose a lot of gray matter. And when we first started, we went in to the stores with notebooks. And we were going around the store and we would be counting, oh, look at this, and we're writing it down. Found out you couldn't write in Walmarts against the law. There are even hidden cameras that looks out of control, but there are hidden cameras and you're immediately escorted out of the store. You cannot write in a notebook in Walmart. Then we started taking photographs. And you couldn't do that either. It was worse than the Exmotica factory in El Salvador. They wanted the film, too. It was the same thing. Only they didn't have armed guards and they didn't beat us up or anything. But they would scream and yell. Taking pictures in Walmart makes us very nervous. Well, we found out that you could act pretty weird in Walmart and no one would say a single thing. So we discovered how to do our research. We used hidden tape recorders, voice-activated tape recorders. And I spent the entire summer in Walmart talking aloud to myself. And so I would go into Kathy Lee Gifford's clothing, and I go, oh, look at this, blouses from Indonesia. 1, 2, 32 blouses, $18. Oh, look at these dresses from Malaysia. 1, 2, 3. And we did this the entire summer. We'd leave on a Friday night, And we would go to a Walmart, can clothing for 2 or 3 hours, go to the hotel, transcribe the tapes. That was even more boring. Get in the car the next day, do 3 Walmarts on a Saturday, transcribe the tapes Saturday night, back to a Walmart Sunday morning, and start all over again. And one Sunday morning, I was in a Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in a supercenter, where there are lots of flags and everything, and I was completely exhausted. And it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'm in the Kathy Lee section, I'm counting dresses and blouses. And now, admittedly, that looks pretty weird. What is this man doing 9 o'clock in the morning counting blouses in the women's section? And a mother was there with her 2 kids, and they're looking at me, and one of the kids started walking towards me, and the mother screams, "Stay away from that man!" And she grabs him by the arm and yanks him away. And I felt like saying, "Lady, this is serious research, you know. One day they'll write about this stuff in the universities, you know." But I kept my mouth shut. That's the other danger of the work is my bag. I travel a lot, but it's filled with all the sweatshop clothing. I can only carry like 2 shirts for myself. But my bags are all full of women's clothing and toys. And when you go through these airports, especially internationally, I'm always nervous. They always check my thing for gunpowder and everything because I look so nervous when I'm going through these detectors and everything. Well, this project with the tape recorders, we ended up counted 105,000 items in Walmart, 86,500 pieces of clothing, and 17% were made in the United States, 83% were made offshore. We counted 16,245 pairs of shoes, and only 16 shoes were made in the United States. Not 16%, 16 pairs of shoes, that was no doubt a mistake. 1,910 handbags and pocketbooks, 0 were made in the United States. Kathy Lee clothing, 11% in the United States, 89% offshore. Faded Glory men's clothing, 13% in the U.S., 87% offshore. McKids children's clothing, 4% in the U.S., 96% offshore. Walmart was flat out lying to the American people. So we thought about suing them. I figured they're always trying to sue us. We're going to turn around and sue Walmart for lying to the American people, false advertising. So we started to research their documents, and we found it. In black and white, Walmart had an unprecedented commitment to purchase American-made goods. And we clapped with joy until we saw the small print. Walmart has an unprecedented commitment to purchase American-made goods whenever they can meet the pricing available offshore. So if you find someone that works for 9 cents an hour in the United States, Walmart will buy your goods. So they had a loophole. But, you know, this is how phony these companies are. And what they're about is really the race to the bottom. And I'll end with this. These 2 pair of jeans, I think, tell a story. They were hanging right next to each other in the department store. They're 100% the same. Britannia jeans, it's owned by the VF now, one of the most miserable apparel companies, a real sweatshop abuser. $17.99, both of them. One difference. One was made in the United States. The other was made in Nicaragua. In the United States, everything is by piece rate. A worker gets 15 minutes. Workers get 15 minutes to assemble a pair of pants. At $8.42 an hour, there's $2.08 of labor in this pants made in the United States. That's 11.5% of the retail price of the garment is in labor. That's typical. It's always like 10% in that area when a product's made in the United States. 10% of the cost is in labor. In this case, 11.5%. When they take the work out of the United States, all they do is translate the piece rate into the local currency. It sounds like rocket science, but it's not. If it's 100 pieces in the United States for $8.31 an hour, when they take the work offshore, it now becomes 100 pieces for 23 cents an hour. That's the great translation of the business people. Well, but they're not inhuman. This is a real science of exploitation. They look at the 23 cent an hour wages in Nicaragua and they say, wait a second. Those people, they're malnourished. Give them more time. Take 5% off the piece rate. Oh, wait a second. It's 100 degrees in the factory. They're exhausted. Take 5% more off the piece rate. Let's give these workers more time. Oh, they work in 12-hour shifts? Oh, that's hard. Let's give them a little bit more time. Take 5% off the piece rate again. So in Nicaragua, the U.S. companies give them a full 33% more time. They give them 20 minutes to make a pair of jeans. 20 minutes to make the jeans. In this pair of jeans, there's 14 cents of labor. They've taken the labor of $2.08, 11.5% of the garment, they've wiped it out to 14 cents, or 0.8% of the retail price of the garment. On every single pair of jeans they would take out of the United States, they'd save $1.93. In this factory in Nicaragua, there's 800 workers making 14,000 pairs of jeans, which means they save $27,000 a day, $162,000 a week, or $8.4 million for the year. That's one label in one factory, and companies like Walmart have 1,000 factories in China alone where there are multiple labels. And you begin to understand where their profits come from. And, of course, the workers' rights were denied. Under the World Trade Organization, under the system as it exists now, which they want to nail into place and extend, corporations want the American people to believe that misery and poverty around the world gives them a license to exploit people, which is a concept that we have to smash completely if we're ever to remake the economy with the human face. Companies right now are completely free to roam the world in search of misery. That's what they do, because you'll find the lowest wages there. Then they can take the American people or people anywhere in the world and pit them against each other in this race to the bottom. Who will accept the lowest wages, the least benefits, the most miserable living and working conditions just for the honor of having a job? There's not one single multinational company that will sit down at the table to discuss linking trade to human rights or worker rights, to women's rights, to environmental protections. Not one. They say that's an impediment on free trade. Well, I think what you're doing here in Seattle is, like we said earlier, one of the most important fights you can have. No country, no company should get an unfair trade advantage through hiring children, through firing pregnant women, through firing and blacklisting trade unionists, through paying starvation wages, through locked bathrooms. No company or country should get a competitive advantage on the basis of that repression. If China enters the World Trade Organization, it'll be an enormous step backwards for human rights. In China, if you try to meet to discuss factory conditions, you're fired and thrown out. If you're even seen discussing factory conditions, if you form an independent union in China, you're going to be put into a psychiatric ward, or you're going to be put into hard labor for 3 years under administrative detention without a trial. And the same goes for religious organizations or women's organizations or human rights organizations. When we were in China, there was a strike. And the way the strikes take place in China is the workers just stop working. They can't have a banner. They can't talk. They can't shout. No slogans. They just stop working. And the military and the police show up and they throw barricades up around the factory so the disease doesn't spread. Then they go in and they interview the workers one by one. And when they think they've pinpointed the organizers, they, of course, get fired and thrown out. The rest of the workers are fined, and they go back to work. It's a frightening place. I was completely blown away. Motorola has invested $1.2 billion in China. You go past the GM plant, and you drive past it for about 10 minutes outside of Shanghai. 10 years ago, it was rice paddies. Now there is a General Motors plant is as big as you can't even imagine it. And Shaw plants, one after another, after another, after another, making all the microwave ovens. And the disparity in wealth in China now is greater than it is in the United States. The top 20% of the people control 55.3% of the wealth. Their Mercedes-Benz is everywhere. The bureaucrats are doing just great. They go around in big, sleek, black Mercedes-Benzes. The one-child policy doesn't apply. One child per family doesn't apply to the bureaucrats. You go to a hotel, $120 a night, and these people are in there with five and six kids, putting them each in an individual room. There's an enormous amount of money there, and yet the workers have nothing. They're paid the 12 and a half cents, the 28 cents. The workers have bicycles, and the bureaucrats have limousines. They're frightening. No freedoms whatsoever. Well, I'm going to end on a good note. This T-shirt was made in El Salvador. It's a Yale T-shirt. And we tracked the workers down who made it. You know, tuition at Yale is $30,000 a year, room and board. The shirt's $14.99. The women were paid 3 cents to make this shirt in El Salvador. And what's happening across the country, and by the way, there's about $1.37 of material in the garment, so you figure out the markup and everything. What's happening across the country with the students, and if there are students here, your movement is the most important human and labor rights movement we have today. The other day, if you saw in the Wall Street Journal, they attacked us and they attacked the students. And the thing that the Wall Street Journal was angry about the most, it was the lead editorial last Friday, was the fact that the students were opposing the World Trade Organization. That made the Wall Street Journal go livid. They went completely nuts. If you haven't seen it, I have a copy. We'll send it to people. The White House is calling United Students Against Sweatshops and asking for meetings. I mean, it is amazing power that you've got right now. The companies don't know how to deal with you. The administration doesn't know how to deal with you. The biggest nightmare a company has, a multinational, is when young people ask serious questions. Where did these garments come from? Who made them? How old were they? Was it a living wage? What conditions do they live under? The minute you start challenging these companies, they wet their pants. They can't take it. You know, they got a whole public relations thing geared up against the unions. And I've watched this for years. If a union comes and says, this company's using child labor, this company's violating the rights of the workers, the company says to the media, oh, come on, what do you think that union's going to do? They're paid to attack us. That's their job. Congratulations. That's their job. If they didn't attack us, they'd be fired. And besides, you can't believe a thing they say, because they're antagonists in the story, we'll grant you that, but you can't believe them. And they get away with that. The $650 million advertising budget for Nike goes a long way. Well, when students come and ask those same questions, the whole public relations propaganda machinery of the companies collapses and falls to the knees, and they're completely panic-stricken. Right now, the students, in my mind, are in the driver's seat of this entire movement. And it's an enormous opening that you have, but it also comes with enormous responsibility. And just finally, when we did this last Kathy Lee story, they try to crash our press conferences to upset them. So we did a press conference in New York and one in Washington. In the Washington press conference, we're on the plane leaving New York, the shuttle to go to Washington, and I'm sitting there and I look up, I'm writing notes, and I look up, and down the aisle is coming this guy, Robert Adler, who actually makes the Kathy Lee Gifford label. And behind him is Frank Gifford, Kathy Lee's husband. And I think to myself, oh crap, you know, going to be a confrontation on the plane. I don't need this. It's 7 o'clock in the morning. I say to the Salvadoran women and the union organizer, I say, just keep your heads down, work on the notes, don't look up, and don't leave the plane. We'll be the last to leave. So, sure enough, we land in Washington, and we let the whole plane empty out, and I stand up to grab my bag, and who else stayed in the plane but Robert Adler and Frank Gifford, like it was high noon or something. And he comes over to me, Frank Gifford, and he says, puts his face in my face, and he says, I just want you to know that I'm following you around and I'm going to be in your face when you're telling all these lies about my wife. And he was huffing and puffing, trying to be intimidating. And I said to him, have a nice day. And he went outside. He got in line for a cab. And we had to get a cab. We went outside. He's glaring at us. Well, we go to the press conference. And, of course, he crashes into the press conference. And we give him the chance to speak. And he walks up to the microphone. And he comes behind me. And he was trying to elbow me in the back and everything. And he starts crying. Too. I mean, this is incredible. And he starts saying, how dare you attack my Kathy? How dare you? She does more for workers around the world than all of you put together. And for children around the world. What about the children? So when he gets done, and he's pointing at me and everything, I say, well, what about the 13-year-old kids in Honduras? You know, what about the 12.5-cent wages in China? You know, what about the hundreds of thousands of young women locked behind barbed wire and working under armed guards who returned to hovels, one-room hovels, and raise their kids on coffee because they can't afford food? What about them? You know, they have a problem. I would say that Frank Gifford and Kathy Lee and their two little kids are the less intellectual side of the World Trade Organization. But they believe that the world revolves around them. Well, they have it a little wrong. It doesn't revolve around them. There are human beings in this world, these hundreds of thousands of young women locked in these factories, and that's where the focus belongs. And I think that's what you're doing here. We can have multiple strategies to go after the World Trade Organization, but one of the key approaches is don't let them take the focus off of where it belongs, and it belongs on the human face, behind that label, behind the product, the exploitation, the starvation wages, the armed guards. That's where the focus belongs, not with Mad Mike yesterday. But one last thing. At this press conference, I'm listening to this guy Adler, who makes the Kathy Lee label. He stands up and he says that Kathy Lee is the Joan of Arc of sweatshops, like I mentioned earlier. And I'm asking him questions, and he tells me, well, the pregnancy testing, oh, that's a cultural issue. We can't do anything about it. Pregnancy testing is a cultural issue for El Salvador. Oh, the 60-cent wages, oh, $1.18 an hour? Oh, he says, I don't know anything about that. You'd have to be an economist. That's a big issue you're talking about. We don't know what you're talking about. Well, he's going on like that, and then Frank Gifford's crying and attacking us. And I was watching one of the students who was there with us, Eric Bracken, who's the head of United Students Against Sweatshops. Eric comes over to the podium, and as long as I've done the work, and of course we're fairly aggressive going after the companies, but by this time I expect the companies to talk like that. That's the baloney that they say. I expect it. I expected Frank Gifford to do that. I didn't expect anything different. Well, Eric and the students are not accepting. And they don't accept that, and they won't accept it. And Eric was standing at the podium, and he started to scream at Frank Gifford and Adler. Gifford left the room, and I was looking at this guy. He looked like a million-dollar bill, beautifully tanned, every hair in place, and he's sitting there like this. And as Eric started yelling at him, you know, not violently or anything, but passionately going after him, I watched his face go from one of, like, complete composure to nervousness. Then he got a little frightened. Then he looked completely confused, and he looked completely out of it. And I realize what's going on here is that there's a new element on the scene, and it's the students. Now, we can run good campaigns. We can do the good research. We can be out there on the streets. The new element is the decency and purity of the students that won't take lies or compromises for an answer.
That was Charles Kernighan of the National Labor Committee speaking on Walmart, Nike, and sweatshops. Thanks to Mike McCormick of KCMU-FM in Seattle for that tape.
Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and progressive action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman.
The problem that we now have created for ourselves is that we have so many rural communities that now perceive themselves as being dependent on prison industries, and so many more rural communities that are being driven by the perception that prisons are going to be their economic panaceas.
For all its Wall Street buzziness, the term economic restructuring may actually come closest to describing the primary effect of the information age. Not since the Industrial Revolution have so many families, businesses, and organizations struggled to adapt to a changing economic paradigm. Even the Internet, with all its early success and accompanying enthusiasm on Wall Street, is only the latest new development in the gradual shift towards information technology witnessed globally over the course of 30 years. But while the Dow Jones continues to soar, rural America is experiencing an economic downswing that started with the demise of small family farms in the 1950s. Crushed by conglomerates and large agribusiness, people gave up their land and moved to the cities in search of jobs. Gradually, produce prices fell, unemployment rose, and large businesses were replaced by national chain stores. Rural America was well on the way to becoming the land of the economically depressed. Enter the prison industrial complex. Today on Bruderhof Radio, we'll examine how the promise of jobs and economic security gave rise to a wave of prison building in the United States. We'll talk about the effects prisons have on local economies and how some are fighting to keep these supposed economic saviors from entering their towns. Tracy Hewling is a filmmaker from upstate New York. She recently produced a documentary titled Yes in My Backyard, in which she examines the response of one community, the Hudson Valley town of Coxsackie, New York, to its own maximum security prison. We spoke with her about the film. Let's start with maybe an obvious question about the name of your film. I think, you know, in the 1980s, the buzzword was not in my backyard with things like prisons and nuclear reactors and garbage dumps, but obviously things have changed. Your film is called Yes in My Backyard. Why the 180-degree turnabout? Why do towns, especially rural towns in the Hudson Valley, want prisons at this point?
Well, rural towns in the Hudson Valley are like rural towns across America. In the 1980s, there was the combination of the farm crisis, which put many family farms out of business, and the sort of wholesale leaving of factories and manufacturing operations as they were relocated overseas. So there was a tremendous decline in, you know, good employment in these areas, you know, employment which paid good wages and good benefits. And then at the same time, we had a huge influx of prisoners starting to come into the prison system as a result of harsh sentencing laws that were passed not only in New York but across the country. So the rural communities at that point began to look at prisons as economic development.
So this is a national trend. This is not only happening in New York and in California, but across the country?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, since 1980, the majority of prisons built in this country have been put in rural communities.
Now, let's talk a bit about the economic benefits that are supposedly coming out of the prisons. What are towns seeing will happen when a prison decides to build in their backyard?
Well, the perception, and that is primarily what's driving the desires of rural communities to lobby for prisons at this point, the perception is that they're going to receive, you know, lots of good jobs, which will take care of the unemployment rates in the areas, that there will be multiplier effects from a prison coming into an area. That is, that the prisons will attract other kinds of businesses, and that the dollars will flow through the local economy. That's the perception, and that is at this point what is driving, you know, small town mayors like the mayor of Coxsackie, New York, which is the town that I profiled in my film. That's what's driving those mayors to lobby their county legislators, who in turn lobby state legislators for not only building new prisons, but placing them in their backyards.
So are these prisons actually attracting other businesses? For instance, in the town of Coxsackie, which you studied in your film, is this happening?
Well, from what, and again, there's been no, I should say that this trend, since it's fairly new and we've just begun to see the effects of 20 years of building in rural communities, there's not been a whole lot of longitudinal studies or, you know, looking at prisons, the impact of prisons on local communities in the long term. But what we do have is a lot of anecdotal information that's beginning to develop, which indicates that, yes, prisons do attract a certain kind of business into the community. And though that kind of business typically are the fast food chains, the regional or national chains, the Walmarts, the McDonald's, they tend to locate in a prison town. The problem with that over the long term is that what we're hearing from people on the local level is that that kind of business has had is beginning to have a depressing effect on local family-owned businesses, the sort of Main Street small-time entrepreneurs who can't compete with the larger national and regional chains.
As Hewling notes, changes in legislation that affect prison population has spurred new construction not only in New York, but across the United States. Craig Gilmore works for the California Prison Moratorium Project, a grassroots organization that opposes the rapid prison expansion currently underway in California. Gilmore says that while prisons are often lauded as economic boons, his experience shows otherwise.
It's paid off in virtually none of the California towns. California's built 23 prisons in the last 18 years. And the state government plans to build four more in the near future. A number of the towns in which prisons were built in the mid to late 80s and early 90s now don't want a second prison. That is, they've seen that the promises that were made have not come true. The city of Avenal, which is a city that has about 4,000 or 5,000, had about 4,000 or 5,000residents, now has twice that many because half of them are incarcerated, hasn't had an increase in the number of people living in town. The sales tax revenue for the town have actually dropped almost 20% since the prison opened. Virtually all the guards in the state system transfer in. They don't hire people from the local towns. And those that moved to the new prison didn't live in Little Avenal. They lived 30, 40, 50 miles away and commuted. And that's been true of virtually every town that's had a new prison go in. Some of the towns in which there actually was some growth, for example, Tehachapi, California, is an old prison town. It's had a prison since the 1930s, but 10 years ago, that prison doubled in size. And the growth of the town actually brought in some, made the town big enough that there suddenly it was a place that some of the national chains went in. And as a result of that and other things happening in Tehachapi, over 700 local businesses have gone out of business in the last 10 years. And the people who worked in those businesses and owned those businesses now, I mean, the alternative for them is now working as managers, assistant managers, or clerks at fast food restaurants or Kmart or Walmart. The only local economic sector that we've been able to identify that actually does benefit in any substantial way are realtors. Because there is, you know, there are some people moving in and out of town. If new businesses do come into town, someone has to broker the land deal. But none of the other local businesses, as far as we can tell, are benefiting.
Faced with mounting evidence that suggests many prisons are failing to make good on their promise of economic benefits, several towns in California are reconsidering the prospect of accepting state correctional facilities. Tehachapi, the town Gilmore refers to, has been the home of California correctional institutions since the 1930s. The prison was expanded twice in the mid-1980s and now holds 6,000 inmates. Then, in December 1998, a local journalist uncovered a secret city council plan to invite a state mental hospital for sexually violent predators to the town. Painfully aware that the previous expansion had done little for the local economy, business owners in Tehachapi banded together and successfully forced the government to rescind their offer. This local business owner, who asked that her name not be used, helped spearhead that effort. Why were you opposed to this new institution being built in your town?
Well, we didn't think that we wanted Tehachapi to become the sexually violent predator capital of the world. It's just the connotation. When you think of Cedro Woolley, Washington, Atascadero, Bellevue, New York. I mean, these names connotate the mental hospital. And Tehachapi, this thing will, whenever it's, wherever it's cited, it's going to be touted as the new big thing. The world is going to know that this is where the sexually violent predators are. So it seemed like common sense that this is not something we wanted, particularly if we want to stress and try to get a tourist industry going.
Now, you mentioned that it seems, at least to you, like common sense that you wouldn't want such a mental institution in your town. And you mentioned also that Tehachapi is interested in tourism. Why, then, is your city council, or was your city council, so supportive of getting this institution in there? What is the positives of such a thing coming to your town, at least in the eyes of the mayor and so forth?
Well, the state is marketing these institutions to small town America as economic development. And the problem is that once you get one, our city right now is, they're feeling a sense of desperation and they think there'll be jobs. The jobs that will be there are for, and that was one of the selling points for us, is it will give us jobs for our children so they won't have to leave the community and go elsewhere. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't really want my daughter being, at 20 years old, being a med tech in a mentalist institution with sexually violent predators. I happen to have a very beautiful young woman, and that's not what I have in mind for her. The other thing is that as the state promises us jobs, but it doesn't pan out that way when they come around to it, our local people aren't qualified. So the job thing is really a mirage. It does not pan out. Also because what a prison does is it adds people. It doesn't add a product that's sold in the community. It does not buy from the community. It buys from state vendors. And the unfortunate thing is nobody thinks of the long haul. They think of the immediate gain.
In a way, the outrage over Tehachapi's proposed mental hospital is no surprise. Still, it's not for any lack of sensitivity, but rather sheer economic desperation that drives many towns across America to welcome such institutions. Henry Rausch is the mayor of Coxsackie, New York, the town in Tracy Hewling's documentary, Yes, in My Backyard. Over half of the population of his small town live behind bars in two separate correctional facilities, one built in 1935 and one in 1983. He says that while the reputation of being a prison town is not always favorable, he, for one, couldn't be more pleased.
The prisons provide good jobs, equal opportunity, employer, of course, good salaries, benefit package, second to none, and your chances for advancement are great. I mean, you can go from a correctional officer or a entry-level stenographer all the way up to the top. And that's been proven time and time again. 4 years ago, of course, the prison uses a lot of our sewer services. So when we upgraded our sewer plant, they paid for that upgrading totally, and that came to a total of $2.7 million, which the Department of Correctional Services paid for. Right now, we're going through a $5 million water project, $4.9 million water project to be exact. The County of Greene, the Town of Coxsackie, and the Village of Coxsackie, and the Department of Correctional Services are partners on that project. And the Department of Correctional Services put $1.7 million into that project. So they pay their fair share. And other people say we wouldn't have to make these upgrades if they weren't using so much of our services. So there are two ways of looking at it. But if they weren't here in the first place, our infrastructure would still be getting older by the day. It would still have to be upgraded. So I, as mayor, would much rather have the Department of Correctional Services presence in the community than not have them.
Taken at face value, the New York Department of Corrections efforts on behalf of Coxsackie are indeed impressive. Still, as Tracy Hewling is quick to point out, their generosity was not entirely altruistic.
There's a context to that story. The context is that for 7 years, the sewer system was overloaded by the prison, and they were dumping sewage into the Hudson River that was not properly treated. And it wasn't until the Department of Environmental Preservation got involved and cited this system for being out of regulation, that there was pressure put on the department to do something about it. So 7 years worth of polluting the river, and could be, you know, other kinds of groundwaters around it, produced that. I mean, they had to do something, and the town couldn't afford it.
You're listening to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly radio program focusing on progressive thought and activism. We'd like to hear from you if you have questions or comments about today's program. Give us a call toll-free at 800-778-8461 or visit us on the internet at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof. When examining the issue of rural prison building, it's hard to ignore the rather dubious connection between rising inmate populations and the demand for new prisons. Craig Gilmore of the California Prison Moratorium Project has studied this relationship and insists that there is a reason why inmate populations have risen steadily in California for the last 20 years. One of these reasons, he says, is harsher sentencing laws, proposed in the state legislature by representatives looking to attract prisons to their rural districts.
The decision to build more prisons in California happened in the early 80s. The prisons started to be built in 83 and 84. the first set of laws, state laws, that really bumped up the prisoner population were a series of laws around the kind of hysteria around inner-city gangs that happened in the mid to late 80s. And then that's been followed by stronger state drug sentences, the three strikes laws, and most recently Proposition 21, which just passed in March, which again sort of expands state conspiracy laws to make it easier and easier for people who are identified as members of gangs to be locked away for longer and longer periods of time. The towns for a while were begging for prisons, and laws are being passed and often sponsored by legislators from those rural districts in which, you know, gang activity is virtually unknown or was virtually unknown. So the people who are sponsoring a lot of the anti-gang legislation are people from districts in which there are no gangs, but districts in which there are prisons. The other major factor that's happened in California is that at a certain point, the prison guard union, just because of the rapid expansion of prisons, has become the biggest political contributor in the state. They support a number of victims' rights groups financially, and they are major lobbyists on behalf of all sorts of anti-crime legislation, meaning legislation that locks more people away for longer sentences.
Tracy Hewling agrees. She cites the so-called war on drugs as another example of legislation that perpetuates the cycle of crime and punishment in order to fill prisons.
We have been, you know, for the last, 7 or 8 or 9 years, at least, as, you know, as long as I've been here that I can remember, there have been, you know, there's been study after study that's indicated that New York has huge numbers of people incarcerated in its prisons for nonviolent low-level drug crimes. When Thomas Coughlin was the Commissioner of Corrections under Governor Cuomo, he would publicly talk about the fact that these people are inappropriate prisoners. They should not be in the system. So you've had a level of intellectual agreement on this issue for a long time, that these people do not belong in prisons. They belong in alternatives to incarceration programs. They belong in treatment programs. They don't need to be warehoused in our prisons at $30,000 a year per inmate. But we have not been able to move at all on legislation that would, you know, move toward decarcerating people who do not have to be there. So when you look at that situation and you realize that many of the people who are most staunchly supportive of the drug laws are also people who are representing the districts in which prisons are being built, you have to wonder. The problem that we now have created for ourselves is that we have so many rural communities that now perceive themselves as being dependent on prison industries, and so many more rural communities that are being driven by the perception that prisons are going to be their economic panaceas, that the pressure that this is creating on state state legislators to do two things. One is to increase and continue the expansion of prisons, and then to continually criminalize more people to fill those prisons by passing, harsh sentencing laws, drug laws, etc., which are criminalizing more and more people who are committing nonviolent crimes. It's a cycle that we've now created that's going to be tough to break.
And like any system affecting the lives of so many people, prisons bring with them a hidden social cost. Craig Gilmore explains.
We've talked to a social worker up in Susanville, where High Desert is, and incidences of spousal abuse skyrocketed after High Desert Prison opened up there. Alcoholism rates skyrocketed. I mean, there was a huge strain on those sorts of
city social services and county social services. I mean, to me, the fact that prisons don't make economic sense is in some ways good news. I mean, I'm finding it, you know, that people are willing to hear that, and it makes sense to people once you explain it to them. It's very hard to gather any kind of reliable information. I mean, we've gathered all kinds of anecdotes, but when people want to talk about changing public policy, they want statistics so often, and the statistics are so unreliable, particularly when you're talking about domestic violence in households of police, sheriffs, or prison guards. The social worker up in Susanville pointed out to us that California law makes it impossible for someone who's been convicted of assault to carry a gun. So that any guard who was convicted of, in a domestic violence case, would be forced out of his or her job. And the wives all know that. So if they call, even if they, you know, if they make a phone call, if they call the police because they're being beaten, you know, they stand to lose the income that supports the household.
What emerges is a picture of a society hopelessly addicted to the drug of prisons. Like any drug, prisons may produce an initial feeling of security, but the long-term economic and social repercussions are disastrous. Sadly, in more and more towns across the country, prisons are being accepted as part of the community. Tracy Hewling.
You know, you have to understand that the long-term political impacts of a prison on a community also create a situation where the prison interests begin to drive the community. They begin to sort of rule the community. And so over time, what happens is that you create an elite in the community by, through these jobs. And those people tend to do what any elite in any community does. They get involved in local politics. They run for county office. So they begin to rule the community. They begin to become the authorities in the community, which, again, you know, is a reason why it's so difficult for anyone to publicly speak out about any concerns they have. When my film was shown on the local public television station here, I got several calls from Coxsackie residents who were outraged that the mayor could be so sanguine about the benefits. And I asked them, well, where were you when I was shooting the film? And would you talk to people? Would you talk to reporters? Would you talk about this in public? Oh, no. Oh, no, we couldn't do that. You know, my husband works for so-and-so, and, you know, that organization is run by people who work at the prison, or my son works at the prison, or whatever it is. Everybody has a relationship with the prison.
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio, a look at prison expansion and how it affects rural communities. For a more in-depth look at how the town of Coxsackie, New York, is affected by its two prisons, you can order Tracy Hewling's documentary, Yes in My Backyard, from Galloping Girls Productions by calling 518-634-2170. You can contact the California Prison Moratorium Project at 510-893-4648, extension 202. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman and Ben Wright. To order tapes and transcripts of Bruderhof Radio, call us at 1-800-778-8461.
You catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be mine.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.